Okay, so this is tutorial 2 in week 5. Now, what we are doing, we're going to be looking at a section of Hard Times, which is actually in the text, both in the Hard Times text, but it's also in the section Industrialism, Progress or Decline on page 1599 in your text. If you want to look at it in the Hard Times text, it's the beginning of chapter 5. And in this morning's lecture, what I was trying to do was to get you to see how Dickens tends to deliberately dramatize his language, because he's trying to get us to see a lot more than just a simple description would evoke. For instance, he shows us, or he describes the teacher standing in front of children in the classroom. He describes the teacher as a dry ogre. And why did he do that? Because he's ironically suggesting that these children have never seen an ogre in a fairy tale in their lives before. So there's a certain sort of subtext that Dickens' language evokes. And you can't miss this flavour of Dickens when you hear Dickens. But as students of literature, trying to fathom just exactly what it is that Dickens is wanting us to see, it's worthwhile taking a short passage, looking at it closely, and asking ourselves what sorts of literary or poetic aspects of language, maybe say devices even, but literary or poetic devices, are used, and why are they used, and how are they used. And here's just a short list. You know, for instance, he word sounds, he uses repetitions a lot, he uses alliterations. What does he use them for? What sort of repetitions have you noticed, and how does he use them? Sentence structure, very, very distinctive feature about Dickens is that he'll either use really long or short sentences, and the sentences have a specific kind of job to do. They work in a certain way to amplify, this is the word I've used up here, to amplify his message or his expression. So Dickens, unlike, say, Engels in here, and the handout I've given you here, it's got some sections from the other parts of this Industrialism, Progress or Decline. There are some extracts from Engels. And Engels, he describes things like a journalist. So Engels, for instance, on page 1595, he describes the River Irk about 10 lines from the top of 1595. He says, "The view from this bridge, which is mercifully concealed by a high parapet from all but the tallest mortals, is quite characteristic of the whole district. At the bottom, the Irk flows, or rather stagnates. It is a narrow, coal black, stinking river full of filth and rubbish, which it deposits on the more low-lying right bank. In dry weather, this bank presents the spectacle of a series of the most revolting blackish-green puddles of slime, from the depths of which bubbles of miasmatic gases constantly rise and create a stench, which is unbearable even to those standing on the bridge 40 or 50 feet above the level of the water." Now, Engels does tell us what he feels. He's got his emotions, and he says it stinks a lot and it looks a horrible colour. But by and large, the language is descriptive in a journalistic fashion. Engels was not an artist, but he certainly described things in a way that made people, you know, horrified at the condition of England. So what makes the difference between that kind of factual description of things and the way that Dickens transforms things into an artistic work? Like, for instance, his description of the circus people standing on top of each other, the implications of that he draws out about the relationship between the people in that pyramid, or the way that he presents Gradgrind talking to Sissy and talking to Bitzer. How does that description tell us just such a whole lot more about his underlying perception than that he's just describing a classroom with a boy who knows the answer and a girl who doesn't know the answer? Somehow the symbolism, the representation of Gradgrind as a character so full of his own self-importance. It's huge what Dickens does within a page. It's just incredible how much extra information is the wrong word, how much extra vision of the whole of England kind of comes through, the whole philosophies, the whole ideas. So when you read a Dickens novel, you are sort of impressed by just the extent of what he sees, the extent of what solutions he wants us to find, and then more importantly, either the beauty, the ugliness, the dramatic vivacity. It's art. It somehow it kind of activates so many more neurons in our brain than just straight description. So we want to have a look at this passage which describes Coketown in the opening pages of chapter 5. And I'm going to read it, and then I'm going to put you into your bananas or pears or pomegranates, whatever it turns out to be, who knows, whatever it is. And I'm going to get you to work together to identify, not necessarily these things, this is just a sort of a short list of possible aspects of language, and I want you to be able to say how these aspects of language create his amplification of his message. What is he wanting us to see underneath the physical world that he's describing? What similes does he use? What does he compare Coketown to? He compared the teacher in the classroom to a dry ogre and said that the children have never seen an ogre in their life. What does he compare Coketown to, and why does he do that? So I'm going to read the passage through. I'm going to give you then time, 5 minutes, to read it again independently, going through with a pencil or a pen, underlining things that you struck your imagination. And then I'm going to get you to work in groups, share your thoughts, and then I'm going to get every group to report back 2 or 3 observations that they found from the passage. Observations about literary or poetic devices and their function. How they enable the reader to perceive or see the world in a different way. Has the names list gone around? Is it back to where it started? Okay. And you know, when you read Dickens, I mean, if you're ever going to become a teacher, Dickens is fantastic because it forces you to dramatize it. You can't just read it straight. You get a real sense of Dickens, the man standing there, speaking it out, dramatizing it. Coketown. It was a town of red brick, or of brick that would have been red if the smoke and ashes had allowed it. But as matters stood, it was a town of unnatural red and black, like the painted face of a savage. It was a town of machinery and tall chimneys, out of which interminable serpents of smoke trailed themselves forever and never and never got uncoiled. It had a black canal in it, and a river that ran purple with ill-smelling dye, and vast piles of buildings full of windows, where there was a rattling and a trembling all day long, and where the piston of the steam engine worked monotonously up and down like the head of an elephant in a state of melancholy madness. It contained several large streets, all very like one another, and many small streets still more like one another, inhabited by people equally like one another, who all went in and out at the same hours, with the same sound, upon the same pavements, to do the same work, and to whom every day was the same as yesterday and tomorrow, and every year the counterpart of the last and the next. These attributes of Coketown were in the main inseparable from the work by which it was sustained. Against them were to be set off comforts of life, which found their way all over the world, and elegancies of life which made, we will not ask how much, of the fine lady, who could scarcely bear to hear the place mentioned. I think he's talking here about things like Wedgwood that were produced and sent all around the world. The rest of its features were voluntary, and they were these. You saw nothing in Coketown but what was severely workful. If the members of a religious persuasion built a chapel there, as the members of 18 religious persuasions had done, they made it a pious warehouse of red brick, with sometimes, but this is only in highly ornamented examples, a bell in a birdcage on the top of it. The solitary exception was the new church, a stuccoed edifice with a square steeple over the door terminating in four short pinnacles like florid wooden legs. All the public inscriptions in the town were painted alike in severe characters of black and white. The jail might have been the infirmary. The infirmary might have been the jail. The town hall might have been either or both or anything else, for anything that appeared to the contrary in the graces of their construction. Fact, fact, fact everywhere in the material aspect of the town. Fact, fact, fact everywhere in the immaterial. The McChokum Child School was all fact, and the School of Design was all fact, and the relations between master and man were all fact. And everything was fact between the lying in hospital and the cemetery, and what you couldn't state in figures or show to be purchasable in the cheapest market and saleable in the dearest was not and never should be world without end. Amen. Okay, read it again for yourselves now. 5 minutes, going through, trying to understand it. If you've got any questions, put your hand up, and then we'll put you into groups and get you to see if you can work through and identify certain aspects of the language and their function. Chapter 5, page 20 in the Dickens text, if you want to read it there. Okay, so we have got a banana here, U3. We've got a banana here, U3. We've got a banana here, U3. We've got a banana here, U3. And we've got a pear and a pear. Go for it. So what am I looking for? I'm looking for examples of literary or poetic devices that give us a clue to what Dickens wants us to see about this world. So if you can identify the device, whether it's a simile, whether it's an image, whether it's something in the sentence structure or the way the words sound or anything symbolic, then see if you can nail that and write it down, and we'll go around the room and we'll get each group to report a couple of... Yes, please. And
can it be more than one?
I hope it's 10, but you'll only be able to report one back.
Okay. So that idea was thinking about the way. Because I'm the only one that has a bad idea thinking about the way.
Yeah.
Is there a difference between accumulate and cumulate?
Cumulate without an A in front of it.
Oh, we got him.
No. You can. Is there a difference?
Yeah, like definitively, and explaining it with, as a technique, is there a difference? Actually, not really.
Oh, yeah, there is. Yeah. As a technique, cumulative means building up. No, you couldn't say that. You couldn't say accumulative. You can't say that. It's a different word. I mean, accumulate is to gather things together. Cumulative is an adjective which describes the building up of something. I mean, they're obviously related words, but they're
not exactly the same.
So you haven't got me.
No, close.
Pretty close. You will. I'm sure you will.
It doesn't mean what we've been doing.
So
do we need a bit more time? Claire, Kyler, and Samantha, I don't see enough interaction between the three of you. Talk to each other. Share your thoughts. Don't hide them all. Have you? Look for more. Find some more. Okay, let's call it quits. So we're going to start with Jasmine. And each person's going to choose one thing. One thing. one thing and you speak about it, and I'll try and summarize it if I can, something there, and we'll talk about it as it comes up. You want, might want to add something to it or amplify it. So go, Jasmine.
We spoke about the recurring thing of the monotonous life.
Sorry, can you say it slowly? The recurrent theme. Recurrent theme, okay. Recurrent theme of monotonous life. Now, you've sort of got the end rather than the beginning. That's, now what literary device or poetic device triggers that sense of a recurrent theme?
Well, I have repetition.
Repetition, give us an example.
It contains several large streets, all very like one another, and many small streets still more like one another, inhabited by people equally like one another.
Good. So in fact, if you think about it, the repetition actually imitates or dramatizes the very thing it's talking about, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The repetition, you could say, metaphorically underscores or underlines what? Underlines the what? What is it? Underlines the observation. So it's a really good idea you've got there, Jasmine, that the actual thing you've detected, which is the repetition, in this case it actually underscores metaphorically, it kind of repeats in the aspect of the structure of the passage what's actually being described. And that's, I think, what all art tends to do, and ordinary conventional prose doesn't. It uses its device to amplify the very thing that's being talked about. Excellent. So now we move on to Nicholas.
Oh, I found the double entendre, especially...
Double entendre.
Yeah.
What double entendre?
And everything was fact between the lying in hospital and the cemetery. On face value, he's saying, because he's just described various places, they're all the same. He's saying, oh, they're the same. But it's also alluding to the fact that the lying in hospital is a maternity hospital and cemetery. So between one's birth and one's death,
good. So what does double entendre mean in this context?
Has two meanings.
Okay. So the two meanings here are really equated, aren't they? So the hospital and the graveyard are somehow put together in conjunction to illustrate the fact that there's no difference between them, or what?
Oh, I'm saying there's face value and there's also the subliminal message where it's actually talking about someone's life. In the sense from their birth to their death, that they're monotonous. And what that does is it gives us also this imagery of the place it's describing, but gives it of the inhabitants which live inside the Coke Town.
So the place as it's described becomes a metaphor for the people that they live in therein as well. Good. Okay. So now I've got Monique. Yeah, that's a good example of symbolism. I can't lay my hands on it right at this minute, but I seem to recall once reading that the idea of a bell in a birdcage is also something that the miners used to take down into the mines to... actually, they used to take birds down in a birdcage as well. So there's some sort of allusion there to the mining activities as well. I'm not quite sure what it is. I'm sure you'd find it if you looked it up. Yes, Nick?
They used to take canaries down to sniff if there was dangerous gas down there.
That's right.
Because what they used to do is put them down and then bring them back up, and if they were dead, they'd know not to mine there because there was dangerous gas.
That's it.
I want to tell something different.
Go on, tell us.
I was reading something about World War I and they were tunneling in the trenches to try and put explosives underneath enemy trenches, and they brought canaries. And if the canary started to die, it means the air was starting to get really thin because there was a collapse further back.
Okay.
So they had to start digging their way out.
So certainly birds and cages has got some kind of sinister overtones, especially if it's being put on the top of a church. Good. So we move on now to Anita.
Okay, well, mine's really simple compared to everyone's.
Yep.
So with mine, there was a lack of full stops.
Oh,
wow. Lack of full stops.
And what do you make of this lack of full stops? So there might be something very profound in what you've said. It might be very simple, but in terms of his style, in terms of what he's trying to convey,
well,
maybe
it's like the students in the class, like bucket, but instead of him like shoveling it through, he's like pouring it in.
Yeah, I mean the lack of the punctuation is an important artistic device in this passage, and the lack of punctuation. Leads him, the lack of full stops in particular, leads him, for instance, if you look at the third sentence, it was a town of machinery and tall chimneys out of which interminable serpents of smoke trailed themselves forever and ever and never got uncoiled. It had a black canal in it and river ran purple with ill-smelling dye and vast piles of buildings full of windows where there was a rattling and trembling all day long and where the piston of the steam engine worked monotonously up and down like the head of an elephant in a state of melancholy madness. So, lack of punctuation, anyone like to help Anita to see the profundity of her observation? How is it profound?
Is it like the stream of consciousness? Where
no, it's not like stream of consciousness.
Well, it's so big that she can't comprehend that that's how big it is. It's just that expansive.
Just ask yourself a simpler question. Ask yourself a simpler question. How does the music... of a sentence that has a full stop so far at the end, how does the music of the sentence capture what is being described?
It sets the rhythm and pace.
It sets the pace, it sets the rhythm. Jess?
I think it's not repetitive in a sense, but when you listen to music and it continues the same sort of rhythm and tone and so on and so forth, when it repeats it, you kind of become accustomed to it, so you slow down as well, physically. So when you're reading something like that, it just becomes so dragged on that you begin to...
It becomes dragged on, and how does that amplify what is being told us? Yes, Claire?
When you're reading it, either aloud or just to yourself, you don't get a chance to pause. It's a very busy sentence, kind of reflects the busy life of the town.
That's what I'm getting close to. It reflects... the nature of the life that's being lived in that town, which is more than busy, it's kind of overwhelming, it's mad, it's crazy. Yes, Nick?
Yeah. Can I just add to that with the world without end, amen part?
Right at the end?
Yeah, it's almost like you're giving a sermon and, look, say for example, saying the Our Father. How many of you have had to say it, say for example, when you've gone to church, and how many of you have realised how monotonous you sound sometimes when you're saying it? It's almost like it's coming through without actually thinking. It comes over second nature. And because of that, you're not emphasizing what's on the words. You're just finding yourself saying the words without really meaning it.
Now, I know that Nick didn't mean to steal anybody's thunder. I know he didn't mean to steal anybody's thunder, but it's building on Anita's simple but very profound observation. If you look at that last sentence on the last page, listen to it. The McChokum Child School was all fact, and the School of Design was all fact, and the relations between master and man were all fact, and everything was fact between the lying in hospital and the cemetery, and what you couldn't state in figures or show to be purchasable in the cheapest market and saleable in the desert, in the dearest, was not and never should be world without end. Amen. Now, as Nick said, with the amen at the end there, it sounds like it's a sermon. But what? But what? No hints. No hints. But what? Not allowed to scratch your head. But what? All right, I'll give you a hint. I'll give you a hint. It sounds like a sermon, but I'm going to give you a hint. I'm going to give you a hint. I'm trying to work out what the hint is without giving you the answer. But where are the sermons in this world that Dickens is describing? Where are the sermons in this world?
Morals.
Church.
Go, Jasmine.
She's scratching her head as well.
In his world? In his world? You're talking about in his world?
In this world, the world of Coketown.
It's outside the church, obviously. He's getting all this from outside the church.
But where are the sermons in this world?
The factories? Lots of speeches.
There are no sermons except for the new church.
That's it. There are no sermons. This is a world without religion, without spirituality, without any... and yet it's presented like a sermon. There's a great kind of irony in the fact, world without end, amen, and yet... and yet, what's the content of this sermon? You couldn't state in figures or to show to be purchasable in the cheapest market and saleable in the dearest. The only thing that is talked about is economic rationalism. There's no sermon here worth talking about. So it's a great spoof. It's an ironic kind of... you know, there's no religion in this world.
But I took it the other way. Sorry.
Take it the other way.
Yeah, like, I thought from the beginning to the end of just that extract, it sounds like it's a cult of itself.
A cult of itself.
Yeah, like,
what sort of cult?
One that's not very religious.
Exactly.
Positive, yeah, so.
That's right. It is. The whole thing is like a crazy cult of economic rationalism, of utilitarianism. Yes.
I'd just like to count that as well, the fact that they're describing... pretty much every single church as the exact same. There's no variation.
That's it.
And religion's meant to be spiritually one of the most important things to an individual.
That's right.
An individual.
That's right. Now, is Stratos striking his head or scratching his finger on
the wall?
It's a bit far-fetched, but it sounds like it's the beginning of sci-fi.
Beginning of sci-fi.
Dystopia.
I was thinking it's giving us like a dystopia, like the imagery he's presenting us with is this town that just has like smoke everywhere.
Yeah,
very brave new
no
world.
Sunshine.
That's right. That's
just,
right.
We juxtapose that with romanticism and we get this utopian image.
Yeah.
It's like a total opposite.
Was my coach the influence of Dickens?
Sure he was. Everybody was influenced by Dickens. Everybody. Everybody. But just come back to this, what I don't know who said it now, the church. On the bottom of that page, 1599, if the members of a religious persuasion built a chapel there, as the members of 18 religious persuasions had done, now there's an irony in there as well, or there's a social observation there in that bit. As the members of 18 religious persuasions are done. What's Dickens alerting us to there, alluding us to in that comment in Coketown?
Which line is it, sorry? Or at the end?
Right at the end of the first page. If the members of religious persuasions built a chapel there, as the members of 18 religious persuasions had done, there's a little kink in that too. What can you hear in that? What's Dickens, by implication, saying there? Sorry?
Religion has failed. To maintain itself.
Well, let's hear a few thoughts.
I think you can go both ways. One that,
Stratos!
About the religion, you know, there's so many different variations that, you know, they can't even decide is it really a real thing. Or the second way you can get it is, man, our town's so messed up that 18 different religions are trying to help us.
Or trying to help them. Yeah, you're on the right wavelength. You know, yeah, go.
Could it be they're trying to be the right one?
Yeah, they're all trying to be the right one. It's something about social history there that the new town builds up. The first people, as all the bloody religions get in there, 18 bloody religions, they're trying to get every... That's it, exactly. Good. Yep.
Don't.
We've had Anita, and now we've got Sarah. Your turn.
I don't know what's left.
Yeah, there's lots left.
I've brought the discussion.
No, you haven't.
Building on what Anita said about the natural response.
Yeah.
I feel like he had a lot of compact sentences all about different. He tries to.
Did you say compact or complex?
Complex.
Complex. Yeah. Actually. Well, you know, a complex sentence, just a point of grammar here, a complex sentence is a sentence which has got a subordinate clause, like the town which was built in southern England became overrun with rats.
Okay,
then that's and compound sentences is where you've got lots of sentences and. So that's what's happening here, actually, is lots of, you know, long... compound sentences, yeah.
I think he tries to get the point in that sentence so he can, like get the person right in the face and just...
What point? What point?
So, like, in each sentence he describes different aspects of the town.
Yep.
So, you know, one sentence he's talking about the machinery, another one's talking about the churches.
Yep.
Then he's talking about how you can't really distinguish a jail from a infirmary, everything looks the same.
Yep.
He'll put each aspect in the same sentence, so the idea of him being...
That's true, but there's... Go, sorry, did you want to add?
Oh, I was just saying there's just one idea, like title and concept, one idea that's a radical difference, or whether it's the same... Yes. Yeah, the same actual idea, but like...
What I'm trying to get you to see, you've got a good,
yeah.
Got a good observation there, and what I'm trying to get everybody to see, we had it already up here, we had it with Jasmine's observation about repeated words... where you've got repeated parts of the sentence, like, for instance, the McChokum Child School was all fact, and the School of Design was all fact, and the relations between master and man were all fact, and everything was fact between the lying in hospital and cemetery. What's important is the fact that the repetition of the parts of the sentence, the accumulation of the parts of the sentence, actually embed that which is being described. That's his cleverness. That's Dickens's cleverness, that he's able to make a statement but devise a sentence that makes the sentence, that makes the idea live in a way that really punches the idea home with the repetitiveness or the boringness or the whatever. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Good. So we're now moving on to Renee. Great! Colour imagery, that's fantastic. So what sort of colour imagery?
The black and white of the town inscription juxtaposed against the red brick, the house is all the red brick they're meant to be with the house.
Yep. There's one other colour she's missed, anybody get it?
Purple?
Yep. So, you know, think of... I always like to think of literature as a painting. If you think of this as a painting and see all those colours there together juxtaposed in that way, what kind of impression or connotation are the colours giving?
Dark.
What else? What other connotations do the paintings give?
Melancholia.
Now, somebody, no one has mentioned the imagery of the serpents and the elephants.
Giving us a chance.
Well, it's time to finish. You're not working fast enough. You spend all your time scratching your head. What about the serpents and the elephants? What about them? Come on, tell me something. Go, Stratos.
They're very symbolic.
Of what? Go more. Yes. Well, it's... I think Samantha's on the money because it's image from the jungle, elephants and snakes, the jungle imagery, and this is very far from nature. So it's a kind of an ironic use of natural imagery to suggest how barbaric it is. You go, Jess?
Barbaric nature of it is described in the third line.
Yep.
Red and black like the painted face of the savage.
Yep,
yeah.
There you go.
Yeah,
painted face, very politically incorrect, even from the times, probably.
It's like Aldous Huxley, the savage.
That's it. What was his name? John something. John.
John Savage, I think.
John Savage, it was John Savage, yep. Somebody else had their hand up? Nick, go on. Last comment. You. Go for it.
Also, irony in the fact that England was also seen as a bastion of civilization, this industrial revolution.
Yeah, yeah.
Yet here they are being compared to, as politically correct it is, savages.
Exactly. So, you can see that we've only exhausted about a third of the class. We've got two-thirds here of brilliant insights yet, which we would need another
Why
2 hours.
Are you pointing at me?
I'm not pointing at you. And you can see how rich this passage is. It's overwhelmed with subtext in there, all these different levels. See some of you tomorrow night at the theatre. Be there at 6
can
o'clock.
Can I just say something?
Yeah, go.
This about last week, you know how I said that I thought Heathcliff was obsessive?
Heathcliff was obsessive, yes.
And he was like a weed lover. Mm. I changed my mind.
Tell me why you've changed your mind.
Because I think Catherine is, and Renee pointed that out today. I think she's being malicious. She's got that. She's the problem, not Heathcliff.
Very interesting.
I was going to say, you got all our names right here. You're on fire.
On fire.
You didn't really go to the whole class. You quit. You didn't really count.
You've got to be there to collect the tickets from me at 6 o'clock.
You come in tuxes tomorrow?
With what?
Tuxedos. Wow. Jackets?
That's fine what you're doing. Jeans? Serious. Serious. Just come casual.
I've got this big romantic thing like
no.
With cocktails
no.
And a sandwich bar.
No. Well, there is a sandwich bar and there are cocktails. No, casual is fine. See ya.
I was like, all right. The first one,
Michael,
I think my next point.
So yes.
For
yeah.
Our blog,
keep talking.
Yep. I'm up to date with all of it, but it's
yeah.
Number three. I've
yeah.
Seen for week three, we weren't supposed to write one, but then I've seen some people write one, so I was just wondering, would I get
you won't get marked down, no, you definitely
if I haven't done that one?
You'll get marked up.
Okay.
I'm not going to be looking that closely at the subjects and whether you've done each week.
Okay.
I'll be looking at the overall quality, what you've done.
All right.
All
right? Yeah, okay.
Good.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Sorry if I can't talk about discussion.
No, that's all right. It's fine. It's good. You helped it. Don't worry. It's good.
Thanks.
Glad you're here.
I want everyone to get a go.
Yeah.
I just want everyone to get a go next time.
Well, that's right. Well, next time, just go come in with some sticky tape on your mouth.
Yeah, I will.
That's a good idea.
I got the duct tape on.
That's it.
Have a good day, Michael.
You too. Bye.